Well, welcome in, everybody, to another installment of Going Nuclear with Trevor and Justin. And with me, as always, is my partner in this endeavor, the Uranium Insider himself, Mr. Justin Hume. Hey, Justin, welcome back.
Thanks, Trevor. Always good to see you. How you been?
I've been good. Lots of travel lately. It's been a little bit since you and I've been connecting, but there's obviously a ton of news that we need to maybe hash out before our interview. That we're going to air. Maybe we'll leave it to you. Who are we welcoming in this episode here for your interview? You brought in somebody real special.
Yeah. No, it definitely is. We're going to be speaking with Bram Vanderelst. He is a uranium trader. He's head of uranium at Curzon Uranium Trading. Very sharp guy, very well connected, very plugged into the physical uranium market. So I think we can have a chat that's focused on the physical uranium market, because for us, that's where we put a lot of our energy. We like to keep our newsletter subscribers up to date on what is happening in the physical market, because if you don't understand what's happening in the physical market, it's very difficult to have conviction in this investment, especially when things are volatile, especially if things are in somewhat of a risk-off environment. So understanding, I can't promise you where the markets are going to go in the next 2 weeks.
Come on, Justin.
based on debt ceiling discussions, and now I'm seeing the market is 50% pricing in another rate hike in July. So you know, I don't know where this stuff is going to happen, but I can tell you with 99% conviction, uranium price is going higher. The spot market is ticking up this morning as we speak. Sput has been hamstrung with a discount to NAV for 3 months solid, after buying just a little bit of uranium in early February. So, you know, the physical funds are out of the market and spot is catching a bid. I'm telling you, it's going higher. And I can tell you that with incredible confidence, because I know what's happening in the physical market. And our discussion with Bram is going to be focused on that.
All right. Well, let's leave that. Let's table that conversation, because obviously it's a long conversation with Bram. Almost, it's longer than 45 minutes. So this part of the show is going to be a little bit shorter. Justin, I think the last time you and I actually talked and published one of these episodes was right before Germany closed down those three nuclear reactors. This makes me shake my head. And at the end of the conversation with Bram, I asked Bram about the geopolitics of nuclear energy right now. And we got a good answer from Bram. I would love to get an answer from you on the geopolitics of nuclear energy right now, where it sits.
Well, it's a simple question with a complex answer. I mean, to put it really simply, the physical uranium market is essentially bifurcating kind of right in front of our eyes. So while we have yet to see actual official sanctioning, well, the UK has apparently sanctioned Rosatom, but the US currently has a bill moving through Congress that will ban Russian uranium products. So it's on the table in the US. But what we've seen over the past year, really, is since a couple months, let's say, following the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, is we've seen Western nuclear utilities voluntarily self-sanction and not engage in new business with Russian nuclear fuel product and service providers. So that would be 10X, that would be Uranium One, that would be Rosatom. And so really what we've seen is a skyrocketing of pricing and conversion and enrichment because of that, because Russia is such a big player in those two markets. We've seen the price of uranium go up about 20% during that time period. And this market is effectively bifurcated as we speak. I don't see that going back to a globally balanced market, let's say, as we had prior to this. And even in that globally balanced market, we still had huge influence in conversion enrichment from Russia, huge influence in U-308 from Kazakhstan. And it's just a more complex market where utilities now are taking a greater focus into security of supply, into origin of supply. And that is playing a bigger factor in utility contracting decisions than I would argue it ever has, or has since the 90s when we had a bifurcated market back then as well.
I don't think anything gets you up out of bed better than uranium talk here, Justin, because I just want to let everybody know it is pretty early your time as we're recording. And when we started recording, you only had two cups of coffee. But my God, once you start talking about uranium, you are perky.
It's, you know, it's such an eventful time right now for this commodity and this investment. It really is. I mean, there's so many huge topics that we could talk about. We could talk about the bifurcated market in detail. We could talk about the fact that the Kazatomprom shareholders today just approved in their AGM agenda number 5. We discussed this briefly with Bram, but just touching on that, there's a proposed very large contract with China nuclear company CNNC. They already have JVs and contracts on the books with Kazatomprom. More and more supply from Kazakhstan is going to be remaining in the East. Very quietly, the primary shareholder, which is the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Kazakhstan, their 75% shareholder of Kazatomprom, pushed for this monstrous new mine called Budenovsky in Kazakhstan to be 49% owned by Russia. We've come to find out that following that pushing of that decision was a bunch of Kazatomprom C-suite hitting the exit door. And that's probably why that happened in hindsight. But the biggest new mine in Kazakhstan for a very long time is now 49% owned by Russia. Now we're seeing this large contract on the table with CNNC that so large that they needed a shareholder vote to approve future contracts in excess of 50% of the book value of the company. No longer have to go to a shareholder vote. And so that's a pretty big deal. And so we're seeing tier one capacity being consumed relatively quickly, both Cameco and Kazatomprom. Orano, most of their production is in joint ventures with Kazakhstan currently, and of course in Saskatchewan with Cameco joint ventures as well. So tier one capacity is going quickly. Price is an accretive environment. You know, the capital markets are doing what they're doing now with influences from the broad market and concerns about recession and debt ceiling, et cetera, et cetera. But man, the commodity is going higher.
Yeah. All right, Justin, I'm going to take your word for this. And Justin, Uranium Insider, we trust. But let's jump right into our conversation with Bram, because it is, like I said, it is a little bit long, but there's a ton of information in here. So let's jump right into it.
Happy to have Mr. Bram van der Elst with us for this month's interview. Bram is head of uranium at Curzon Uranium Trading. He is involved with the Zuri Invest Physical Acquisition Fund that is being set up, is currently in their first round of financing, and that should be closing relatively soon. We'll discuss that briefly. And Bram is very well versed in all things physical uranium. Looking forward to getting into that. So Bram, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem at all. Always happy to chat with nuclear enthusiasts. So I think it's going to be a good discussion.
Awesome. I'm sure you're very busy. I'm top of mind, no doubt, with anybody listening to this interview, is going to be the launch of the Zuri Invest Physical Acquisition Fund. So if you are listening to this or watching this and you're not familiar, could you just go ahead and give us kind of an overview of this fund? I know that it has a number of different parameters that are very different from the popular physical funds and physical trusts that exist now, which would be Yellowcake PLC, listed as YCA on the London Stock Exchange, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, listed on the TSX, and of course, Sprott has made waves over the past couple of years with a couple of very significant moments in time where we had a backwardated market. They were purchasing uranium hand over fist. The markets went nuts all around that action. But they've been trading at a persistent discount to NAV, I think, every single day since mid-February, if I look back on it. Correct. So I know that that's problematic for some investors and perhaps maybe one reason why this fund was launched. But why don't you just give us kind of a brief overview of the nature of this new vehicle?
Yes, so there's a few major differences between the Zuri Invest AMC and the existing vehicles that are out there. one of them, and you've already touched on it, is the discount that these vehicles are facing. So they've been trading at a significant discount, and over time, typically the discount widens. We've seen this happening with UPC, Yellowcake, and unfortunately, it looks like Sprott is heading that same direction. And so the Zurich Invest AMC is essentially very close to what an ETF is, or an open-ended mutual fund, and it trades at net asset value. So the way that we achieve that is by having a redemption feature. So if there is outflows of capital, the physical uranium gets sold. When there's inflows of capital, physical uranium gets bought. And it trades at a consistent net asset value. And net asset value is published on a daily basis via Bloomberg. And I would probably say that's the major difference between the existing vehicles and the Zurich Invest vehicle, because that gives investors exposure to uranium as a commodity, and nothing more than that. It's purely uranium, and whatever the equity markets are doing, whether Credit Suisse goes belly up, whether the ceiling on US debt gets extended or not, it doesn't really matter, because the vehicle mimics the performance of the physical uranium price and nothing else. And that's not the case for these other vehicles, where there's a lot of interactions with your global equity markets. And then there's a few minor things that are also different. I think that the liquidity is one. So essentially, because everything gets backed into the physical market, the vehicle, the Zurich Invest vehicle, mimics the liquidity in the physical market, which is at most times pretty decent, at least for larger sizes. So if you're a larger hedge fund, family office, pension fund or anything else, you should be able to invest 20 million and that gets deployed in the physical market without much, like too much of a difficulty. Whereas that might be more difficult in some of the other ventures out there, especially if you go into the sort of the mining sector. And then it's just a different jurisdiction. So it's launched out of Switzerland. It's got a Swiss ISIN number, so it's a Swiss security. It's not trading on an exchange. It's a primary market only. And that means so you won't find it on a stock exchange, but you'll find it through its ISIN number. And so people should be able to invest in it through their bank, quoting the ISIN number and be able to buy and sell it through their bank or their broker. So I think that's in a nutshell what the product represents. There's probably a few nuts and bolts that are different and that people can look into. But what I suggest people that really want to know more, that they go to the Zurich Invest website. So zurich-invest.ch, I think it is. And then look for the product. And there's a term sheet there. There's one pager there. There's a presentation there that can all be looked at and will have all the information needed. And if not, I'm sure Patrick, the asset manager at Zurich Invest, will happily assist the investor with finding out more information.
Hey, Bram, Trevor Hall here. Thanks so much for joining us here. And a general question about the timing of all this. It has been a fairly exciting, let's give or take 3 or 4 years in the uranium and nuclear energy sector. And we kind of feel like we're on the cusp of something really important as far as an energy renaissance and the use of nuclear power here. But so tell me about the timing of all this. Some of your peers, obviously Sprott was launched 2 years ago. Why is now the best time for Zurich to kind of enter the market with a little bit different of a strategy than your other peers?
The timing is, we didn't plan it as such that it would be right now. Ultimately, timing is dependent on how long it takes to set up a product. And when you go into a product like this, it always looks like it's 3 months away, but the reality is it's much longer. And so we've actually been together with Zurich Invest, been working on this product for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And when you marry up more traditional Swiss asset managers and an AMC is a very famous structure in Switzerland, but it's not very well known outside that, and you marry that up with a sort of an opaque market like uranium, it takes a while to get things set up. Anything from setting up an account at Cameco to hold the uranium, to getting the investors and the asset manager and everybody comfortable. But so we've been looking at this product pretty much throughout 2022, and launching it now. And that was on the back of what we saw as investor interest in general, because without interest, you obviously don't have a product. And that's only gotten better because the sector is more widely understood. And I think I would almost say you have two different types of investors. You've got investors that follow the sector and that know the sector, and they are already invested in Sprott and Yellowcake and the miners and stuff. But then you got a big emerging sector of investors, which is the generalist investors, who are now realizing that there's an energy renaissance, as you called it, and that are realizing that nuclear is part of it and they want to play a role in that. So we sort of saw that trend happening, and we went on the back of that. Plus also we saw some issues with the existing vehicles out there. There's no such thing as an ETF in uranium, which you have in any other commodity. If you want to invest copper or iron or oil, gas, you name it, it's all out there. And we sort of looked, okay, what can we do that is as like-minded to an ETF as possible? That isn't an ETF, because that would have taken us 5 years to launch. So that's sort of the timing. The timing sort of worked out really well, because you're right, we are on the cusp of something here. But that's more by coincidence than anything else.
I do want to follow up here on the strategy and really kind of pinpoint the differences between Zuri and the likes of Sprott. And I think one of my we had them on, actually. I think it was the very first podcast we did of Going Nuclear, Justin. I think he was the first guest. And I remember asking him, and I said, you know, one of the my own big criticisms of that trust is really they just hold on to the uranium. Whereas Zuri, obviously you have to sell within however the mechanics is trading at the time.
It's purely investor driven. So yeah. Investors want to pull their money out and it gets sold. We don't take any discussions. It's investor.
Okay, so my follow up question is really the difference in risk profiles here. I mean, because if you see a big liquidity event in general in the markets, that means you will most likely be selling a ton of uranium onto the market. And then that risk profile, if you're a consumer of uranium, then that's probably the time you're going to be loading up. And so I'm just curious about the general risk profile of the physical uranium market in those times of massive liquidity.
That's a very good question. And I've been asked this before. There's two points that I want to unpack there. First of all, for a big liquidity event to happen and have an effect on the spot market, there needs to be volume in the vehicle. So this has an assumption that there is significant volume, and that would have driven presumably the price of first, or at least would have tightened the market in a big way. The second part of that question is the setup of the market currently is one of an undersupplied market, and all predicting models looking forward are predicting that setup isn't changing anytime soon, unless miners can really surprise on the upside, but somehow I doubt that. And so what you're talking about is a potential liquidity event in a tight market and in a market that's still undersupplied, unless we want to talk about a liquidity event 15, 20 years down the line. And so will that have an impact in price if this is an external liquidity event? Yes, obviously it will. And if we see another Fukushima and I'm knock on wood that it doesn't happen, then we're talking about a different kind of thing, set of rules here. But if we're talking about a liquidity event in a sort of a risk-off period in general markets, then I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing for the market. It's a time, as you said, it's a time for utilities to load up on material, because they're going to need that material, because it hasn't changed any of the supply demand dynamics in the underlying market, which is the physical market. And you'll see that regardless of whether Zuri Invest is in the space or not, you'll see that liquidity event play out in some shape or fashion anyway. If Sprott were to be trading at 30% discount because there's a liquidity event in the general markets, there will be somebody who's arbing that and who will sell the physical and buy Sprott and vice versa. And so in one way or another, you'll have that happening anyway. This is just it's a more direct vehicle for investors to have a view on a market like our market. And I actually think that's a good thing. That just creates liquidity, creates transparency, because a liquidity event doesn't necessarily mean that that is wrongly priced. It just means that at that point in time, that's where the uranium should be priced. So, yeah, the long and short of it is I think it's actually a good thing.
Mm-hmm. It seems like an excellent way of playing the physical uranium market without actually having to hold physical uranium. you know.
Well, that's Zero Invest. The reason why Zero Invest has really jumped onto this was they loved what they saw. It's a way of owning physical uranium without owning physical uranium, in a very simple, transparent, and straightforward process, rather than having to go through an intermediary, the whole custodian thing that loads of funds would need, or even setting up a trading arm on their own, which is not their forte, or without going into an equity that's listed on exchange, which it's idiosyncrasies that are the discount and whatnot. So it's a very simple and straightforward process.
Bram, I actually have to correct you on something really quick here, which is that UXC in their latest weekly product had quoted a representative of Rosatom at the recent IAEA symposium saying that the market is balanced going out to 2030, and maybe we'll see 140 million pounds of deficit by 2040. So there is a lone voice out there that's saying that we've got a balanced market. I don't know. I would love to see that spreadsheet that came up with that statement. But
I would imagine that spreadsheet is based on including inventory drawdowns and inventory patching up supply deficits as balancing a model.
Right.
But we all know that that's not really what, like that's not a supply demand model. Supply demand model shows you a deficit or a premium, and by definition, that deficit is filled by inventories or a premium goes into inventory.
Exactly.
But it's a different narrative, and it's a narrative that I actually have seen. I like that you touch on this topic, because it's a false narrative I've seen a lot in the market, where models account for deficits and say, well, people are just going to fill it from inventory. Yeah, that's true. That's the only way you can fill a gap, and vice versa on if you've got an oversupply. But the narrative shouldn't be, well, the model is balanced. The narrative should be, no, there's a massive gap, and the balancing factor is the inventory, which is a finite item. Right.
Even though inventories essentially do account for that plug number when we're talking about an annual supply and demand deficit, inventories do account for that. That doesn't mean the market's not undersupplied. That doesn't mean that undersupply of the market and inventory drawdown doesn't have an effect on the price of the market as well.
Because think about a general investor who doesn't know the market as well as you do or as Trevor does, and they'll read a headline and go like, well, the market's balanced out until 2030. They're not going to really look at this market. They're going to see a market is imbalanced by, call it 25, 30 million pounds every year until 2030. But there is potentially some inventories that can fill the gap, potentially. Right. It's a totally different way of looking at this market.
Right. Yeah, good point. I want to make one more point on the Zero Invest vehicle before we move on and talk a little bit more about the physical market just in general, which is, there's actually two things that I think are very unique about this vehicle. And please correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but the first thing is that pretty much, 99% of an investor's capital that goes into this vehicle goes to buy physical uranium. So with, in comparison with the Sprott vehicle, which you could argue has more immediate term liquidity, it has the opportunity to kind of arbitrage that discount to NAV. And we've seen it go back and forth, kind of, and to your point, it's been more at a discount to NAV more consistently as the vehicle matures. But even when that vehicle is at a premium to NAV, only, let's say, and this is according to John Cipaglia, the CEO of Sprott, up to 60% of the daily volume could potentially be them, on the offer with the ATM. So even if they're at a premium to NAV, and let's say I want to buy $100,000 of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust in the open market on a day where we're at the premium to NAV, maybe 50 or 60,000 of that will go to physical uranium purchasing, which is significant, especially when the capital is really flowing and we have this flywheel effect that we call it, like money's coming in the ETFs are buying Sprott, Sprott's buying uranium, et cetera. But with the Zuri Invest vehicle, all of your investment is going to buy uranium minus a small fee, correct?
It's correct, but I have to caveat that when there's orders coming in at the same time, there will be matching orders on buy and sell sides, because the underlying mechanism would have been otherwise. The orders that come in will have bought physical uranium. The orders that are sell side orders would have had to sell physical uranium. So there's no reason on doing the loop via the physical uranium side if you could just match them up. So at times of very high liquidity where you would see MATNAC buy and sell orders at the same time, I can't say that 99% of all the incoming orders are going to go into the physical market, but I would imagine, and I can't vouch for it, but I would imagine that there will be a higher allocation to the physical market than 60% because of the way that the setup works.
Of course. And that obviously depends on the nature of the capital markets at that period of time.
Correct.
And the general direction of the commodity pricing environment.
So as I said,
it's fully capital market driven.
Sorry, you'll be buying at spot price at that time.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
The other detail I think is important is that you've mentioned in the past when we spoke last month that Zuri Invest will essentially be purchasing for front month settlement. So basically, is that within a 30-day window? Is that what you're referring to?
That's the intention, yeah. They will settle. And again, it's our belief that the market will self-regulate to make material available in that front month if they need to. If our market is typically, like the physical market, is typically in contango, and it has, like in my more than 10 years in the space, has only tipped in backwardation very briefly, I think once or twice. And so in an environment where there's a lot of money flowing into this, we're buying front month, and the front month is sort of dry in terms of volume. There's always a capacity for somebody who's sitting on inventory to flip out that inventory at a backwardated price if the deferred, let's call it 12 months or 24 months, is trading at a backwardated price. However, what that person will do, they will take that risk on the deferred delivery. And we don't want to expose the investors in the Zuri Invest vehicle to the deferred delivery risk. And therefore, it's important that we buy at that front month and that the capital that is raised is deployed in physical uranium. Physical uranium is in the storage in storage in Cameco as soon as possible. And that's the highest likelihood of having the material there and then when you need it. For the vehicle. Whereas if you buy at 12, 24 months, it's very unlikely, but something can go wrong. You never know what happens. Like your supplier can go bankrupt and you might not have that material and you're now exposed to a much higher market. So that's the reason why we went for that front month. And the market will always self-regulate to make that material available because there's a price for everything.
So just to be clear on this, Zuri Invest, they're looking, the goal of the raise that if... Correct me if I'm wrong. It's Thursday, May 25th that we're recording this right now. I believe it is. It set to close tomorrow still? Are we still on schedule for that closing?
The subscription period will close tomorrow, which basically means that from that point onwards, and I don't know the full details of it, like how it then actually fully closes, but then like a week later or something, it's live and then the daily nav is published and it's an open vehicle that then runs from that
point onwards. Gotcha. And so if we were to assume, let's say, that the financing goal was essentially reached and we're sitting here at 54, 30 something a pound mid-market in the spot market right now. So if Zuri was to go in for, let's say, 1.7 million pounds at 54, 37 a pound and doesn't get filled right away, how will the fund actually operate? Will they essentially raise their bid until they get filled rather than go out for a 60 or 90 day settlement?
Correct. And there's a bit of discretion on the Zuri Invest site. And so ultimately what you're trying to do is trying to get best value for your investors. But you also don't want to deviate from the stated statements too much. Like if somebody were to offer like say 35 day settlement versus having to raise your bid price by $2, then it obviously presents better value for your investor to do that. So there's a bit of discretion in, and this is why like it's not 100% mechanical.
Right.
But the intention is to act as mechanical as possible, i.e., just buy the front month at whatever price that the front month is trading at, and until you find the material.
Very good.
Can we talk about the general market here, the physical market, Bram? Maybe, I guess in conjunction with the equities, And we had this discussion last month. I mean, Justin just mentioned where the spot price was a few minutes ago. I mean, it's kind of been just kind of flatlining here, I would say, above that $50 per pound mark. But why are the equities in such a disaster right now?
That's a question to ask Justin more than me. I don't trade the equities. I trade the physical. I think there's a... It comes back down to the point I was trying to make earlier, is that equities are in the dumpster because the general equity markets are difficult right now. If you look at commodity equities, and you'll notice, like, it's not the best time for commodity equities in general. And uranium being such a small allocation in most people's portfolio or on that risk side of the high risk side of the portfolio, those are usually the equities that get cut first when people need liquidity or when people are in a risk off environment. And I think that's what the uranium sector is really reeling from a bit. Plus also we've seen the uranium prices or the equity prices on uranium related equities. We've seen them going up quite a lot in 2021, 2022. And I think there's an element of profit taking and going back to normal. So I think that it's a dual thing that plays there a bit, but by all means, Justin, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the expert here.
Oh gosh. Yeah. I mean, it's just been a general risk off environment for the most part, for the better part of the last 12 months. And I agree with you. It's a small sector. It's very volatile. There's not a ton of liquidity. Back in early March during the banking crisis, I mean, there was a single fund that we heard about. There probably was more than that, but just the action of a single fund kind of basically having exposure to the failing banks, essentially getting margin called on a larger scale than the retail investors usually used to, just has to sell what they own. And they did have a position in a number of, you know, large cap uranium equities and ETFs, and just a single fund de-risking with a decent amount of money triggered a waterfall of selling that, you know, retail just hops on. There's a lot of fear. It's subsiding a bit now, but there's still fear around general macro elements that are affecting all markets. And this market is just so small and illiquid that it tends to be coupled with other things when it's not being driven on its own accord. A couple of bright points, I would say, over the last 6 months, that when the spot market moves, the equities do tend to at least follow. Whether we haven't seen high volume breakouts because of the spot market movement, but the move from $48 to $53 caused equities to go up 20-25%. And so I think in a rising commodity environment, if we actually have some momentum for the price of the commodity, it's likely that we will at least be in a better position than if it weren't. And it's possible that we will actually see some flow of capital out of other sectors going into something that is working. So most of the equities in the space are up decently since the March lows. I think there's just a general patience needed for this trade. This is something that we always recommend against using margin, always recommend against short-term options. You got to know that you're going to be in this for a number of years and be patient with it and understand the thesis. It's not for the faint of heart. With all of that said, I Bram, probably the same. I imagine extremely constructive on the outlook for the commodity itself going out into the next few years. So we're just being patient here. But Bram, yeah, I'd love to move on to a couple of other topics within the uranium Sure. market, if that's okay with the time that we have. And we continue to hear about the emergence of more physical funds. So not only have we had the Zuri Invest vehicle, we just spoke with Askar Badarbayev, the former CCO of Kazatomprom. Very, very nice man. Really appreciate his takes on the market. I think he's always been an honest customer. He now is an analyst for the sector, a consultant, I should say, excuse me, for the nuclear sector. And he couldn't share very much, but he did say there's yet another physical fund coming on the scene. Recently, Treva Klingbeil from Traytech did a webinar with, I believe this was last week, and she spoke about, if I recall correctly, saying, you know, another 3 to 5 something physical funds that are in the works and talking about launching. And I mean, we could be at the end of the year here with 7-8 plus physical funds competing for spot market pounds, which from my standpoint looks to be a relatively thin market. We know, primary production that does sell into the spot market seems to me to be somewhere in the realm of maybe on average 2 or 3 million pounds a month if you were to average it out. Possibly it's a little bit less or possibly a little bit more depending on the month and the demand in that period of time. But it doesn't seem to be like there is a lot of liquidity there. And I'm imagining a scenario when capital markets go back into a risk-on environment and flow into the sector. I think it's a matter of when, not if. What is the spot market going to look like with a number of physical funds competing with each other, let alone actual uranium traders or possibly even end users? It seems like they're migrating more towards the term market, possibly because of some of these elements in the spot market. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we're making an assumption here that the funds are set up in a similar way that they will dip into the spot market. And I do believe that there's quite a few funds, that if there's a few more funds out there, that they will have taken a different approach and they will probably would have tied up preferential access to material, either with the Kazakhs or with other producers. I don't know. I don't have any inside information. But assuming that there's other funds out there that are all vying for physical market material in the spot market, yeah, it's gonna get pretty brutal. It's ultimately, if I can take a step back and unpack that a bit further, what our industry has always struggled with is that the purchasing has always been much more discretionary than the selling, because miners want to get offload things out of their balance sheet, want to monetize the material that they mine, and that's it. Whereas because of the long lead times of how uranium or the uranium cycle works, utilities have been able to buy very discretionary. If they don't buy today, they don't need to buy tomorrow, not next month or next week, but they can postpone that for a year if they need to, or even longer. And we've seen that, for example, when the review of the suspension agreement was happening, I think 2 years ago now, where basically all utilities said, you know what, we're just going to wait for this to be over and we'll wait a year and then we'll figure it out. And then coming back to your question, what would be interesting about these physical funds is that all of a sudden the purchasing doesn't become discretionary anymore, but the purchasing is a must purchase kind of vibe. And that has a much bigger impact on prices than the discretionary nature of uranium purchasing by utilities. Because what we've seen in the last, call it 2 or 3 years, we've seen it's a few positive events in the pricing, but they were all driven by spot mostly because they needed to purchase. And for the rest, the market is sort of like formed higher lows and sort of ticked up higher. And that's just that's a way that the undersupply is playing out, but that's not going to drive your price massively up. So it could get interesting with funds all vying for material because they can't just say, hey, we're just going to sit back and not buy. At some point, you need to be invested. So that's going to be interesting. In terms of liquidity, I think it's hard to really put a number on it because it really does vary month by month. And what we see on the liquidity side, it's very much driven by certain miners who are not contracted, and therefore their material sometimes appears on the market. And not to name for Uzbekistan, for example, but
right.
Some others.
BHP, that, potentially. And that
possibly. And those are like sort of short-term liquidity events. And what we typically see is that because all of a sudden the market takes a direction or the market makes a material available, that traders jump on the bandwagon and all of a sudden all pent-up demand and pent-up supply just all comes to the market in one go and trades, and there's a lot of churn and there's a lot of activity, and then it goes flat again. Mm-hmm. And then we see like a month of like where nothing happens and you hear trades done in the background, like not necessarily on the open market, and there's still trades going on, but not as active. And so it's really hard to put a number on it. It's hard to really say what's churn and what's primary material, because that's a really big distinction. Like churn shouldn't necessarily be counting towards liquidity as such. So I guess if I had to put a number in, your numbers are probably relatively close to the truth, but with the caveat that it can be really different in different months. Right. And so depending on what months these funds might need to buy and when the material comes in, they might run into some inventory that's been building up over a time that there wasn't really much activity. And then you might come into like 500,000 pounds of material that that doesn't move the price, and it and all it takes is five traders who just were long 100,000 pounds who said that now is a good time to just offload it, and the market is this, and especially investor people don't hear a peep. We'll in the physical market we'll know about it, or at least we'll have an inkling. But then there's times where somebody needs to do something, and everybody's just naturally either naturally short or more likely just flat. And then you're looking for 100 or 200,000 pounds and you just can't find it. And you're like, okay, how do I, it's either increasing the price or it's just waiting until the next liquidity event. And so it's the timing is going to be very important. But I think the underlying assumption is if all the funds are coming out in this, at the same time or consistently across that time frame, it's gonna get interesting.
Bram, and I guess maybe this is a follow-up question for you and also Justin, whoever wants to chime in here. And I'm just, I mean, listening to this, it seems like there's going to be continued pressure on the end users or the end consumers here of uranium. And so if they have more of these funds coming online and consuming more of the physical market of uranium, if you are an end user of that product, then you've got to be paying real close attention. At least I assume you're paying really close attention, because in the way this conversation alone, I mean, we could certainly see a more expensive spot market, which means you got to cover those costs, which means you got to feed it into the consumers of the energy. And I'm just kind of thinking, you know, how close are these companies following these new funds coming online, and what is there anything potentially they can do about it?
There's not much you can do about it. But I want to give utility buyers some slack, because they're usually being put away as like, well, they're not very intelligent, or they don't know what they're doing, or they're too slow to react. That's not really the case. Utility buyers know exactly what's going on in the market. They got their ear to the ground. They know what's coming, but they've got their restrictions as well. And they manage their book in a way that we can't see it. So especially the larger utilities in the world, they're pretty well hedged, or at least they've got a book that covers them for the next few years. So to them, the spot market as such, to go into and cover immediate needs isn't all that important, because they've got sufficient inventories that they can flex up and down. They've got cover, like contractual coverage that they can flex up and down typically, and they've got contractual coverage that gets them a few years away. However, that doesn't mean that they won't be looking at this market and saying, well, I've got still openings further down the line, and they're ultimately going to be exposed to this same spot / long-term price anyway. So I do need to think about a longer-term plan. And a lot of them do. A lot of them have gone to their primary suppliers, the Cameco's, Orano's, Kazatomprom's Proms of the world, and gone like, well, can we extend deals? Can we buy longer dated supply? And we see that on every Cameco conference call, Grant tells the market that they've locked in more pounds. We see the same sort of noises coming from others. We see it happening by the juniors, or the Greenfield and Brownfield junior miners, who have all started saying, well, we actually got an MOU or coverage, or we got a deal with the utility. So utilities are taking steps. But there's always a section of the utility sector that believes, well, this market is wrong, or we're seeing more material, so we don't necessarily want to cover for a variety of reasons. It could be just them not having the budget, or their CFO telling them, look, don't buy $75 uranium in the forward market. Let's just wait it out and we'll buy spot, because we think spot's going to stay at 50. Or I don't know what that would be, but there's that section of the market that isn't taking action. And unfortunately, they're going to be the ones that, if this market really starts rallying, that ultimately is going to get found out.
Could we?
That's how I look at it.
You know, and I want to take this one step further, and be patient with me how I'm taking this. So earlier in the week, we got news out of Ford that did a lithium deal with five companies, only two of which were actually in lithium production. The other three are in development stage. So obviously, pretty risky for Ford. I'm just very curious if we could see something similar replicated in the utility side. There'll be these contracts, not these contracts and supplies happening with current producers, but Could you see utilities actually coming into late stage uranium developers in a similar fashion that Ford did in the lithium? And would that be, kind of a oh shit market in an oh shit moment in this uranium market?
No, I think that's what we're actually seeing at the moment, is that most of the primary producers are tapped out to a large extent, or are demanding higher prices or different contractual terms that drives those utilities in the hands of those late-stage developers. And we've seen a lot of those late-stage developers being successful. Mm-hmm. Boss Resources, Global Atomic, some others that have all, some of the US guys have stated publicly that they've signed committed contracts. And I think I've mentioned this before in different podcasts and stuff, and I think this is the risk to this market, because you're now exposing a market or utilities to developmental supply, and you're a mining guy, so you know how risky that yep. is, and how many mines have actually come online on time. Not that many in no commodity. So I think our market has really tightened, not just on the spot side, but it's tightened across the curve, and is very, very exposed to mining issues in any shape or form, whether it be licensing, technical, operational, whatever it might be. And that will be the oh shit moment potentially, where people are, or utilities are, expecting supply, and it might not be there, and they're gonna need to find that supply somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And again, utilities aren't stupid. I'm sure they've got contingency plans in place, and they're probably overcovered to a certain extent. And if everybody does deliver on time, then they'll just they build their inventory to a certain extent. But on aggregate, it's an issue.
It's interesting because it's like it certainly. If it's happening, it doesn't have the same wow moment that Ford doing it. Obviously, Ford is a real household name. Utility companies are more like, you know, regional or local names than anything else.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit more, it's smaller. Yeah. Because also what we're seeing currently right now as well is the deals that are getting signed aren't for massive volumes. Like these utilities are signing deals for 200,000-400,000 pounds per year with each miner, which is actually, in the grand scheme of things, not all that much. And especially if you're a large utility, if it doesn't deliver, it's not the end of the world. It just gets drowned by the rest of your book.
Sure.
But again, we need to talk about this on aggregate. On aggregate, if these guys don't deliver, then they're gonna need to find that material somewhere else. And the primary miners are largely tapped up anyway. And so it's really. The story in our industry is not so much an investor story as such. I mean, it's a nice little thing if you're a bull on uranium, but it's the undersupply story, that how that's going to play out, and when is that going to manifest itself into the market? Because an undersupply can only be solved by more material coming out of the ground at some point, and that is a mining risk by definition.
Yeah, really interesting points. And I completely agree with you, Bram. I think that the investing side sometimes tends to kind of badmouth the utilities and say, oh, they're so stupid. Why aren't they covering, you know, can't they see what we see? Why aren't they buying hand over fist right now? And I think it's important to put a little bit of context, which is, you know, the utilities, the operational costs for a nuclear power plant are significant. Especially in terms of labor force and the workforce and the amount of money that goes out for the production of energy at a particular plant. And so across the fuel cycle, uranium conversion, enrichment, fabrication, all of that combined, my understanding is that somewhere in the tune of like 13 to 17% of the overall cost of operating that plant. And the utilities have already seen conversion and enrichment prices jump, you know, double and almost triple in the last 12 to 18 months. And the uranium price has gone up 25% over that period of time. So there's a lot of catching up to do. And the uranium price itself, the uranium cost for the operation of the power plant, is only about 4% of their operating budget, to speak generally, broadly about it. The other thing to put into context too is existing fuel buyers throughout their entire career have never seen a moment in time where they haven't been able to find material. So that has never happened. And so to think about utilities going out and securing pounds in the ground from a development company, I think we're still quite a ways away from that happening, if it happens. What we have heard about is, for example, the CEO of Occidental Petroleum mentioning that they are interested in looking into potentially diversifying into, I think she had mentioned lithium, if I recall correctly, and nuclear uranium. So we could see some very large multinational mining and oil and gas potentially producers diversifying into other elements of the energy sector. And I think that's something that's very, very interesting going forward for this sector. But to go back to the physical market, you know, as a percentage of total pounds purchased or even traded, we should say purchased by end users. The term market takes the cake, right? So there's not on a comparison, term versus spot, 100%. The term market is 80%+ of pounds purchased by end users. And we're already seeing a lot of pounds secured in the term market this year, 99 million pounds year to date. As of the first 4 months of the year, actually, we're towards the end of May here. But that, of course, is skewed by a couple of very large contracts that Cameco signed with Energoatom and with Belarus, if I recall correctly. But either way, the picture that I'm seeing here is that the term market, we're seeing tier one capacity being contracted relatively quickly. So, for example, if you were to average out Cameco's contract book right now for the next 5 years, it's somewhere around 26 million pounds a year. Their share of their production of MacArthur and Cigar, plus their share of Inkai on an annual basis, with Cigar and MacArthur at 18 million pounds a year, Cameco's share is about 26 million pounds a year. So they're essentially, for their production, is pretty much fully booked out for the next 5 years. Now, of course, we go into the hypothetical Cigar phase two in the 2030s. MacArthur has still a lot of pounds in the ground. They've got capacity going out beyond that. But looking at this big contract that's being proposed, and we still don't know the volumes from Kazatomprom. They just had their AGM today. They voted in favor of the line item number 5, which allows the company to approve transactions between 50% and 200% of their book value. Askar corrected us in our conversation the other day that with CNNC, this proposed contract could actually be adding to volume already signed under contract with CNNC. So it's not that this new additional contract is necessarily greater than 50% of the book value, but the total contractual amount with CNNC between Kazatomprom prior contracts and the new proposed contract would be in aggregate greater than 50%. It still might very well be a very large contract. We don't know yet. But the picture I'm seeing is that tier one capacity is being consumed relatively quickly. And when that happens, let's say when the bulk of that capacity is contracted out, let's say going out to 2030, then we move to the next tiers, which is brownfield restarts. And gosh, you know, the spot market being extended as it is with physical investor-driven funds playing in that market and tier one capacity in the term market, I'm forming this into a question. I'm getting there. Tell me how we don't see a price spike scenario with this particular situation, considering the supply and demand situation going out for the next number of years.
That's a hard question because I don't have a solid answer for it. Look, there's a few scenarios where this doesn't happen as a price spike. One is obviously Black Swan event where the world weans itself off nuclear again, but let's leave that one aside. There's a second scenario which is possible but unlikely, in my opinion, is where utilities altogether take the right decisions and start contracting at a reasonable level. With new mine or with greenfield projects, sufficient time in advance for the mine to develop while they allow themselves the time to live off their inventory and existing contract books, that ultimately we see, and I'm going to coin a term here from the Fed, a soft landing, which is, in
don't
my
say
opinion,
landing.
Which, and what I mean with that is that there's a scenario where this market moves into the sort of $70-$80 per pound uranium pricing in a very steady manner without real a big upswing. But the big caveat there is that the utilities on aggregate contract in such a way that it gives enough lead time for miners to develop their mines, that miners do deliver and get their mines up and running on time, that we don't have investors lining up who are going to completely screw this soft landing idea up. But that's a possible scenario. But I would still see us going into ultimately marginal price of production, which in my opinion is somewhere in that 70-80 range, depending on what time frame you're looking at. And so that's one scenario where you don't really necessarily see a price spike, but you see prices going up significantly. And then the third scenario is one where, and this is even more unlikely in my opinion, is where we have a look at where are the big inventory, like the big sources of inventory sitting, and they get released with a view on suppressing the price. And that's like China, which they've been trying to do on like other commodities, iron ore, oil. But I would imagine that uranium is a bit more strategic for them, especially in how they've looked at it. And if I unpack China's strategy, I quite like what China is doing. They're sort of the third, a third, a third, which is third domestic, a third mines that they own internationally, and then a third from the spot market. Ultimately, China only has an advantage of suppressing the price if they're exposing their book too much to spot purchases, which they kind of do in that last third. But the domestic and the international mines that they own actually benefit from higher prices. And if anything, if the price really shoots up, they've locked in that strategic capacity to produce at that point a lower cost than the prevailing markets. So they probably couldn't really care that much about prices at that point going higher, mm-hmm. which is also why we're seeing China quite aggressively looking at assets right now, because they recognize it and they think, well, assets is really what's going to shield us from higher prices in the future. So that's a sort of the inventory scenario. And then as a second, and next to that scenario, I would say, well, what if a government's come into play? Whatever government says, you know, like a sort of megatons and megawatts program again, or God knows what it is. Again, very unlikely, because you tamper with the open markets and that hasn't gone really well in the past. So why would it now? Mm. But that's a possible scenario. So there's just a few options that I'm giving you. It's up to you to decide how likely you find them, but those are a few things I can see.
Bram, I want to be cognizant of your time because we're kind of coming up here. And I have one last question for you, and we can maybe keep it as simple as possible from your answer. What we've talked a lot about the spot market, obviously. What we haven't talked about in this conversation is the geopolitics of what's happening in the uranium sector. How concerned are you around the geopolitics of nuclear energy?
It's a good question. Concerned. Well, concerned for the world, not so concerned as a physical trader, because as a trader, you like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm concerned with geopolitics in a way that it's a few very important decisions that can really sway this market in a big way. And it's like banning of nuclear fuel supply from Russia, mostly on enrichment and conversion, or retaliating, or the Russians retaliating if they get banned by just saying, well, we're going to stop supplying right now. That's a major concern. The general geopolitical situation between the US and China. China has been open for business for a long time on uranium, on nuclear, controls actually a lot of the trades within the physical trading site. There's two big Chinese trading companies that are actually doing a lot of contracting. And so in one way or another, a lot of miners, utilities, traders are exposed in some shape or form to them. So a further breakdown in those relationships might be an issue if further sanctions are imposed. So yeah, I'm actually concerned, because it would really alter the flow of materials around the world. And uranium is it's quite truly a global commodity. And until very recently, it has actually been flown across the world in a very open manner, or at least to a large extent, like leaving China out of the equation a tiny bit. So a breakdown in those free flows is going to be a real issue. But it would be, and be an issue for nuclear in general, because the underlying story for the nuclear sector is there is enough uranium. You just need to get it out of the ground at the right price. And so it's about pricing. It's not like the commodity mm-hmm. isn't available. And I'm ultimately a nuclear bull. I think that nuclear power is as good as a nuclear source, as good as an energy source that we have right now. I'm very optimistic and positive on SMRs. I think that once the corporates tag onto that, which is currently happening, it's gonna be sped up in terms of its development. Because when corporate money flows into the need for a zero carbon but sustainable supply source of energy, that's really when there is enough backing for those SMR developers to really get going and have the backing they need and away from government interference or government subsidies. But once there is a disruption on supply, if the geopolitics play out, a lot of that will fall away because corporates and governments alike will look at it. Well, we can't guarantee the commodity that fires up these plants. So why would we even consider those? So I think that's a real concern. And I think that's if any sort of outside event can derail the nuclear renaissance, it's the geopolitics.
All right, Bram. Thanks so much for your time. That was very informative. And good luck.
No, you're welcome.
Good luck with this with the acquisition fund and the launch of it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Bram.
Great pleasure chatting. Yeah.
Yeah. Appreciate your time. Good to see you.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Going Nuclear, Justin, or myself, and the Clear Commodity Network team and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.